Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, Chronicle of a Death live streamed, the disturbing case of Jean Pourmaneuve. All aboard the Alpbach Express, strategy and politicking in the Austrian Alps.
You go to the countryside, you're within these mountain ranges, and then you have to think about the future of Europe. And I think it's a good spot.
Fear and loathing, just what exactly is happening in the UK. And Turkey cashes in on the Syrian reconstruction bonanza. That is all to come here on Inside Europe. We begin the show in France, not with the looming political crisis triggered by Prime Minister François Bayrou's decision to call a confidence vote he is expected to lose. That is for next week. No, this week we wanted to take a look at a bizarre and disturbing story that could have wide-reaching implications for both online safety and our understanding of consent, both on and off the live stream. The bare facts of the case are this. Last week, a man known as Jean Pourmaneuve died on camera during a marathon live streaming session in which he was repeatedly and gratuitously abused, both psychologically and physically. An autopsy has found that the likely cause of death was either medical or drug-related, so in other words, not as a result of a blow. However, the disturbing incident has shed an uncomfortable light on the popularity and prevalence of live-streamed abuse and raised a whole host of uncomfortable questions to which there are no easy answers. Here's John Laurenson's report.
Jean Pourmaneuve, a frail 46-year-old whose real name was Raphaël Gravenne, doing what he was famous for, being bullied by two younger, stronger men, Naruto, as he called himself, and Safine. Being hit and spat on, shot with a paintball gun covered with various liquids. It was as if he had been shut in some seedy cellar with a couple of psychopaths, he and another on-screen victim figure, a young man with learning difficulties. But this is how Pourmaneuve earned his living. People paid to see him being hurt. On Monday the 18th of August, after 12 days of continuous live stream, viewers could see Pourmaneuve's body, motionless, underneath a duvet. One of his tormentors threw a water bottle at him. He still didn't move. He went to look at him, saw that he was dead, stopped the live stream. 40 minutes earlier, some of the viewers of this show of the Australian-backed streaming platform Kick say they heard his last breath. Some of them posted images indicating that they thought he'd just died in front of their eyes. At the top of the screen, viewers could also see two counters. One showed the duration of the live stream, over 290 hours, that some have described as 12 days of torture. The other, the amount of money contributed by viewers in order for it to continue, over 36,000 euros. In effect, paying to see the abuse of Pourmaneuve for his suffering to keep going. The show that most people in France have discovered with the news reports on Pourmaneuve's death had 160,000 subscribers plus 500,000 on TikTok. It was by far the most popular on Kick's French platform. At the end of last year, the investigative news site Mediapart published an investigation into Kick's French content, focusing on Jean Pourmaneuve. The police arrested Naruto and Safine 3 days later before letting them go. The Mediapart journalist Marie Tourcon said this on French public television.
À partir de ce moment-là, les streamers ont deux choix. Soit ils se disent on a compris qu'on a fait quelque chose de problématique et on arrête.
After their spell in detention, they could have realized that what they were doing was wrong and stopped. But they were making too much money and the viewers were giving too much money to keep it going. So they went off to Malta for a few weeks while things blew over before returning to Nice and starting the violent stuff again. That's what the viewers want. That's what they pay for. But even now, after his his death, they think it's us who misunderstand them, that we are haters, that they were just playing roles, that they loved Jean-Paul Manoff, really. It's just that they also love to see him suffer.
Qu'est-ce qui faisait que, sur Internet, l'énervement fait vendre plus? Qu'est-ce qui se fait? Mais c'est aussi dans la société générale.
Mediapart tried to contact the minister in charge, Clara Chapez, when it published its investigation. She didn't reply. Following the death of Jean-Paul Manoff, however, she spoke of mistreatments, which, said Philippe-Henri Honegger, Naruto's lawyer, was premature.
Soit choqué, très bien, mais quand on est un homme ou une femme politique, on respecte la.
She has the right to be shocked, he said, but when you're a politician, the first thing you have to do is respect the principle of innocence until proven guilty. The second thing is not to try to influence the judiciary when there's a judicial investigation underway. She's being contradicted by the autopsy. I hope now that the politicians, but also the media, will show a bit more prudence.
Dans le respect de la présomption d'innocence de celui que je représente.
That's what you'd expect him to say, replied the minister, who gave an interesting insight on French public radio into her dealings with Kik before Pormanov's death.
S'il y a une chose que ça, dans laquelle ça me conforte de voir ce qui s'est passé, c'est que il y a urgence à ce qu'on sorte de ce Far West numérique.
This affair reinforces my conviction that we've got to get out of this digital Wild West, she said. It's not easy. It's not happening fast enough, but there's no red button solution. The reality of the digital world we live in is that there are no rules, although we in Europe are starting to bring a legal framework to the internet to make digital platforms responsible for the content they provide. If it weren't in the digital space, this sort of deviant behavior wouldn't be tolerated for a second, and it shouldn't be tolerated on the net either. But let me tell you what we're up against. I had an exchange with Kik. They're in Australia, on the other side of the world. So you have some Australians on a video conference call, wearing T-shirts, slumped in their armchairs, who don't even begin to measure the seriousness of what's going on, whose only argument is they consented to this.
Des Australiens, donc à l'autre bout du monde, en visio, en T-shirt, avachis, absolument pas la mesure de ce qui est en train de se passer, et qui n'ont aucune réponse. Nous donnent des arguments, ils étaient consentants.
Kik has now issued a statement saying it is deeply saddened by Jean-Paul Manoff's death and has suspended all those involved in the live stream pending an internal inquiry. Meanwhile, the results of the French criminal investigation that began in December are pending. John Lawrence and DW, Paris.
Time for an alpine detox. And what better setting than Alpbach, a small village in the Austrian Tyrol. Be warned, though, it's not all cowbells and hiking boots. That's because 80 years ago, in the wake of World War II, Alpbach began hosting a series of seminars designed to act as an intellectual springboard for Austrian and European reconstruction. Today, Alpbach's European Forum attracts thousands of participants from around the world, and there is a lot to discuss. Inside Europe's very own Laura Kabelka returned to her native Austria to cover the event for us.
Some call Alpbach Austria's most beautiful village. Traditional wooden houses, flower-filled balconies, and in winter a popular ski resort. But every summer, shortly before a new political season starts, the European Forum Alpbach, or the IFA, transforms this quiet valley into something rather different.
Very special welcome to you, also Minister from Romania. Welcome.
For 2 weeks, politicians, business leaders, artists, scientists and students pour in to debate their visions for Europe's economy, security, climate and democracy. The IFA is not your typical conference. Here, panels take place on mountain hikes. And in between sessions, students and ministers come together to talk and eat in village restaurants or alpine viewpoints.
You leave your home, you go to the countryside, you're within these mountain ranges, and then you have to think about the future of Europe. And I think it's a good spot to think about these serious topics, having a lot of sunshine and hearing the cowbells on the Alps.
The spirit has drawn people back time and again.
I came here the first time in 1965.
The first time must have been about 10 years ago.
It's my third time.
I was here 23 years ago for the first time as a small student, so I would never have imagined to sit here once as a foreign minister. So I'm really proud.
But the forum also wants new people and different, sometimes controversial, perspectives. This year, one speaker in particular caused a stir. Niall Gardiner from the Heritage Foundation. That's the right-wing US think tank behind Project 2025. A 900-page blueprint of radical conservative ideas, many of which are now reflected in President Trump's policies. Forum organizers said they invited him to foster dialogue, but a few dozen students protested against it.
We were about 30 people gathered together in the morning to shortly make a sign that we don't want to support this kind of foundation.
That wasn't the only protest. Next to pride and climate protests, participants also rallied against the mass-scale killing that day and organizations including Israel's leading human rights NGO B'Tselem say is genocide in Gaza, as well as the military occupation of the West Bank. There was also a panel dedicated to the question of Palestine and how Europe has historically been involved in the region. It's the forum's 80th anniversary, so time for a bit of Altbach history. What started as a series of international seminars with a focus on science and humanities soon began to include the business sector. Now, around 40% of participants come from the corporate world. Civil society, politics, and students make up far less. The forum may seem like a parallel universe in this idyllic setting where CEOs, politicians, and students mingle. But still, the topics debated reflect the real world. The Russian full-scale war in Ukraine and the recent high-level talks with Trump were big on the agenda.
We hope the United States will review their approach and increase the pressure by sanctions, hopefully also by restarting a program to deliver military goods, weapons to Ukraine, which are bitterly needed. We need to understand, we in the European Union, that this is our backyard. We can't ask America, each time there is a huge problem in Europe, to bail us out.
This was Wolfgang Ischinger, president of the Munich Security Conference Foundation Council. Europe's dependence on the US was quite the talk of the town. Gabriel Felbermayr, the director of the Austrian Institute of Economic Research, said that it's one reason why Europe ended up with a 15% tariff deal last month.
What we have learned over the last years is that we cannot talk about economics in isolation. The security concerns have pushed us into a bad agreement with the Americans right now, for example.
Others voiced concern about Europe lagging behind in technology, what alternative trading partners Europe should turn to, and whether institutional reform is the way to go in times of an increasingly fragmented EU.
We have to recharge Europe. The battery is empty. After a lot of crises, you had the financial crisis, you had the euro crisis, the migration crisis, then following Corona, the spirit of Europe on the long way has been lost.
Armin Laschet there, chair of the German Bundestag's Foreign Affairs Committee, who laments Europe's lack of a unified voice. War, crisis, polarization. The agenda at Altbach sounds rather bleak, but the people here seemed hopeful.
When you see, okay, there are so many young, motivated people who really want to change something, this is basically what gives me hope. Yeah.
Karl Popper, who was one of the founding fathers of the European Forum Altbach, he famously said that we have an obligation to be optimist. We have so many good things, and we should start feeling our strengths again, and not only thinking about Europe as the old continent in decline. But in order for this optimism to be realistic, we need reforms.
Let's see what impact the discussions and networks sparked here in the Austrian mountains will really have. Laura Kabelka, DW, Altbach.
Our very own Laura Kabelka there with the ultimate "it remains to be seen" line. Whatever happens, we'll be following it here on Inside Europe. Tensions are running high in the UK at the moment. Nigel Farage, leader of Britain's anti-migration reform UK party, announced a plan this week to repeal human rights laws to allow for mass deportations of asylum seekers. The justification? The prevention of what he warned could be major civil disorder, a claim in large part fuelled by sustained, if small-scale, protests that have erupted in various places across the UK where hotels are being used to house asylum seekers. Our partners over at GBH's The World podcast have been following this story closely. Here's their Europe correspondent, Orla Barry.
In mid-July, Epping, a sleepy English town known for its local forest and its transport museum, became a flashpoint for anti-migrant protests. The demonstrations kicked off after reports emerged that an asylum seeker staying in one of the town's hotels had been charged with sexual assault. Some of the marchers shouted support for national far-right extremist Tommy Robinson. There were lots of counter-protesters too. The Epping Hotel houses 140 asylum seekers, and in late July, the local council called on the government to shut it down. Last week, a High Court in London ruled in the council's favour, granting a temporary injunction that would see all the asylum seekers forced out by mid-September. A small group of protesters, draped in England flags, gathered outside the hotel, poured champagne into white plastic cups and celebrated. Within hours, the leader of nearby Broxbourne Council said she planned to take legal action too.
My issue, as I said, is the groups of men that are arriving here on the boats that will probably not receive their right to stay in this country, but they're not deported. So they're walking around the streets and we do not know who is amongst us in the community.
Corina Gander, the Conservative Council leader, tells me around 300 asylum seekers are staying in a hotel in her area that's already attracted protests. Gander says she understands why some residents are angry.
The people that are protesting are being classed as far right, but they are people that are protesting to protect the borders. And I think Britain is now saying, you know, we've had enough now.
Around 30,000 asylum seekers are being housed in hotels across Britain. And the rising wave of protests has left many feeling frightened.
Scary, like, that's the only word to describe it, scary.
Scary, says Khadar Mohammed, who's staying at the Epping Hotel. He spoke to ITV News.
A lot of guys took some beating, you know, in the beginning. It's scary.
The Populist Reform Party, led by Nigel Farage, is advising all 12 councils under its control to launch legal challenges. Even a number of Labour-led councils say they're now seeking legal advice. Refugee rights groups say the issue is being used by all parties to score political points.
Every single party is pointing fingers at other parties. You can't do this, you can't do that.
Steve Smith, the CEO of one of those groups, Care for Calais. He says there is one thing everyone agrees on, and that's that hotels are not the answer. More than 20 years ago, Britain had a similar number of asylum seekers arriving, he says, but with one key difference.
There wasn't the manic hysteria in the press. There wasn't the same emotion around the whole situation. You know, people were just integrated into communities. Their claims went through. They were either accepted or they were rejected, and we moved forward.
The Labour government has talked incessantly about cutting down on the number of migrants arriving in Britain, Smith says, and now it's backed itself into a corner.
None of the solutions are going to be easy for the government, unfortunately, because the current government has, if anything, contributed to the demonisation of asylum seekers.
The British government says it will appeal last week's High Court ruling, and says it plans to overhaul the asylum appeals process, which could lead to more deportations. But that's unlikely to stop the protests. And it leaves one big question unanswered. If the hotels close, then where will the asylum seekers go? For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Our thanks to our partners at The World for permission to share that report with you. Just time for one more story now, so let's join Inside Europe's Istanbul correspondent Dorian Jones, who has been keeping a watchful eye as the Turkish construction industry sizes up all those juicy contracts opening up across the border in Syria. Opportunities that, thanks to the recent lifting of US and European sanctions, are now wide, wide open.
In Damascus, under the watchful eye of Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa, Turkish construction giants Kalyon and Cengiz, along with Qatari companies, sign a $7 billion energy contract to help rebuild Syria's electricity infrastructure, destroyed by more than a decade of civil war. Kalyon chairman Orhan Jamal Kalyoncu claimed it was an historic deal.
Today we signed a very big agreement in Damascus. A contract was signed for the production of approximately 5,000 megawatts of electricity to meet Syria's electricity needs. We have a strong partnership and the means. God willing, we will start work as soon as possible.
The multi-billion dollar contract was only possible with the recent lifting of US sanctions and the easing of European financial controls on Syria, which not only made available frozen funds, but also opened the door to energy-rich Arab nations to invest in the war-torn country. One of the most pressing tasks facing Syria's new rulers, along with the return of a reliable supply of electricity, is rebuilding the country's cities and towns. Turkey's construction industry is well placed to meet the challenge, according to Veysel Yayan, Secretary General of the Turkish Steel Producers Association.
The Syrian city of Aleppo is 2 hours away from Turkey's southern border. So I don't think meeting the Syrian construction needs will be a problem for Turkey. Turkish contractors can go to any part of the world where there is no infrastructure by taking all their assets with them, including building materials, machinery, etc., and finishing the construction project within just a few months, a period that many contractors say we cannot even plan in such a short time.
Turkey's construction industry is among the world's largest, and many have close ties with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. During the civil war, Erdogan's government was a key supporter of the rebel group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. Now that its leader has become Syria's president, Attila Yeşilada, a Turkey analyst for the profit consulting firm Global Source Partners, claims they are well positioned to cash in on lucrative contracts.
I look at the regional countries with excess capacity to provide the cement, construction materials, the wherewithal and the engineering capacity. Turkey is the only one. So not because of our political relations with Tahrir al-Sham necessarily, but because of economic necessity, Turkey will be the cheapest provider.
A speedy reconstruction of Syria is also in Europe's interest, helping to facilitate the return of millions of Syrian refugees. This is a significant consideration for Ankara too, of course. Mostly, however, Turkey seems to be hoping for an economic bonanza. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
And on that most constructive of notes, sorry, I couldn't resist, just time for me to remind you of our feedback address, insideeurope@dw.com. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn, where the school kids are back at their desks, but the weather is still balmy and I am reluctant to let go of the summer. As it happens, are some of our correspondents.
I'm Lars Bevanger in Oslo, and my favourite thing to do in summer here is to head to Sognsvann, a lake on the border between the city and the extensive forests surrounding it. It's just a 20-minute metro ride, but a world apart from the busy city centre. Here I can run, swim, or simply lie down with a good book all day. Sognsvann has been a popular recreation area for Oslo dwellers for over 100 years. In 1945, after 5 years of German occupation, people were more eager than ever to enjoy their regained freedom. The authorities viewed outdoor pursuits as an essential part of Norway's post-war regeneration and made sure areas like Sognsvann were accessible to all, young and old, families and workers. Today, it's lovely to see that more recent Oslo residents from around the world are using Sognsvann actively too. My first Sognsvann experience came in the early 1970s when our grandmother would roll out her tiny Renault 8 from her shady garage to drive us there. I distinctly remember the smell of sun-baked plastic when we got back into the scorching hot car in the afternoon, wet and happy. It's a cherished memory that adds to the delight I feel every time I go.
I'm Danny Mitzman in Bologna, Italy, where my favourite thing about summer, apart from the obvious daily dose of gelato, is our spectacular outdoor cinema in Piazza Maggiore, the city's main square. Surrounded by porticos, palazzi and the landmark unfinished basilica, I can't imagine a more evocative setting for the giant screen, the largest in Italy. From mid-June to mid-August, you can watch a different movie every night, sometimes presented by the director, occasionally with a live orchestra playing the soundtrack, and it's absolutely free. With around 2,000 chairs, it's first come, first seated, but many bring their own, or you can usually find a spot on the church steps. Organised as a two-part festival, screenings kick off with Il Cinema Ritrovato, featuring old classics restored by Bologna's internationally renowned Film Institute. There are cult movies and some of the year's most acclaimed releases in the second part of the festival, enchantingly named Under the Stars. Gazing up at the twinkling sky, I always feel immense awe for this perfect blend of artistic, architectural, historic and natural beauty. And the icing on the cake? On baking hot summer nights, it's the only place in the city centre with a whisper of a breeze.
I'm Dorian Jones in Istanbul, Turkey. Istanbul, home to 15 million people, is noisy and packed, with traffic jams, overcrowded public transport, and an unrelenting din. But with summer, millions leave the exhausting city, the poor returning to their family hometowns and villages, and those who can afford it to the beaches of the Aegean and Mediterranean. For Istanbul, the exodus brings a couple of precious months of relative calm, where everything seems to work better. But the siren call to leave is irresistible. For me, not the beaches, but the mountain plateaus of the Black Sea, known as Yayla. The plateaus with their stunning flora and fauna that blooms just a few months offers an escape from the stifling humidity and heat, and an oasis of silence and tranquility. With breathtaking views that seem to go on forever, time seems to slow down. And visiting this true hidden paradise, for me, is the best thing of summer.
Summer may be drawing to a close, but we are going to eke it out just that little bit further with that rarest of Inside Europe occurrences, a bona fide sports special. Yes, that's right, sports. It doesn't happen often on Inside Europe, but when it does, we go all out. So, coming up this half hour, we have the World Transplant Games, a Slovenian biking legend, and an Italian palio race with a difference. To the World Transplant Games first, which have just finished here in Germany, with the city of Dresden playing host. Thousands of people who have been touched by what they refer to as the gift of life came together for a week of competition and camaraderie. Amongst them, three-time kidney transplant recipient and four-time member of Team USA, Kai Dambach, who also doubled as our reporter on the ground.
It's the gold medal basketball match in Dresden, Germany. Italy versus the USA. It's overtime. Next basket wins. This might not be the biggest game in the basketball world, but if your life has been changed by an organ donation, this is where you want to be. Let me explain. Every single person out there on the court has received a new organ. Some have had liver transplants. Others are living with the heart, kidney, pancreas, lung, or bone marrow transplants. Everyone from the basketball court to the squash court and the swimming pool. Every one of the more than 1,500 athletes from 51 countries vying for a medal at last week's Biennial World Transplant Games in Dresden, Germany, has lived this reality either as a recipient or a donor. That includes me. I participated in this year's games and I've had three kidney transplants. I was born with kidneys that did not work. My dad gave me a kidney when I was two, but complications after the surgery meant we lost it. My mom stepped up 2 years later and that kidney served me well until I was 22. Then, a childhood substitute teacher of mine reached out to my parents and nonchalantly said she could save my life. It turned out she was a perfect match. She gave her gift 11 years ago this month, and it's still working strong. In fact, all of my donors are still going strong. Going strong, that's what the games are all about. Liz Schick, president of the World Transplant Games Federation, and herself a liver transplant recipient from Switzerland, said as much, even when she didn't win a medal at the 2023 games.
I was last in the sprint triathlon in Perth, and it was an honor. All I wanted to do was finish and not give up. So if anyone wants to volunteer to come last, come and see me later, because last is fabulous. And there again, of course, I do speak from experience.
Someone had to come last, and Schick was there to greet her.
Liz Schick is like, she's pretty cool, bowing down to me as I finish the kid. Yeah, she's my BFF. It's great.
That's Maria Weaver Holonicki, a kidney donor who came to compete alongside the woman who received her kidney, Liz Kasparite. They ran together the whole way in the 5K road race.
I knew all I wanted to do was finish it in the hour that we were allotted. And I will say the two gold medalists after us were both in their 80s.
Right.
So, but we finished. And that's what was really important
together,
to me.
Together.
Exactly. And then, like, for Maria, that's what was really important, finishing.
I don't mean to one-up Maria, but I came last in four events this year. Squash, ball throw, shot put, and discus. I didn't get a medal, but I was there, still doing my best. And when you can't beat them, have fun anyways and pump everyone else up in the process.
You need a ball?
Yeah. Got too excited.
Yeah.
It's wonderful to finally be around people who understand what this experience is really like, what it feels like to get the news that only an organ transplant will save your life. All the doctor's visits, tests, poking and prodding, waiting to find out if you have a match, all while your health declines each and every day. The transplant itself is almost the easy part for recipients, as we're just napping for a few hours. Then, the new life begins. The cheers for surviving to this point fade, and the daily maintenance takes over. Ah. Pills and pills and pills. By my rough estimate, I've taken over 160,000 pills in my lifetime, all with their own set of side effects that can get in the way of starting life again. Not to mention dealing with the side effects from surgery, too. For me, this included wetting my pants every day until I was 13, getting several precancerous moles removed from my skin, losing the enamel on my teeth, vomiting every day as a kid, wild mood swings, growing hair all over my arms and legs, among other things. So being here, standing here, living here, is nothing short of incredible when looking back.
Last but not least, the donors and donor families.
But this isn't just a celebration of the recipients getting a second, third, or fourth chance at life. In fact, there is one group of people who get special recognition. Without organ donors, there wouldn't be a World Transplant Games, such as Bennett Hazelton from Seattle.
I donated a kidney in 2000 to a stranger that I was matched with through the hospital. And then in 2019, I donated a piece of my liver to a baby at a hospital in New York.
He went on to get two bronze medals at the Games. Sometimes donations happen in the most heart-wrenching circumstances. Beth Hesley, a mother of three, watched her youngest baby, Malcolm, struggle with a heart condition before it suddenly took him away.
He was just seemed perfectly healthy, happy, bright eyes, like third child, laid-back attitude sort of thing. And he went to his nine-month checkup. That was all good. And then 2 weeks later, he got very sick, and he was in the hospital about 5 days before he passed away.
The decision for Beth and her husband, Chris, to donate Malcolm's organs after his death was a no-brainer.
For us, it was the easiest decision. I mean, obviously, it wasn't a decision we wanted to make, but I think this, if we can save somebody the same grief and the same pain that we went through, like, why wouldn't we do that?
Malcolm is still with them no matter where they go. A teddy bear named Hero Bear, in remembrance of Malcolm's donation, has joined them on all their journeys, including watching the family take 5 medals with them back to the U.S. Every 2 years, we get to witness something special. More than 1,000 athletes whose lives have been shaped by the gift of life, be it by receiving an organ or giving one away in the ultimate act of selflessness, come together for a week of camaraderie and celebration. And if you're Marco Mestriner, a kidney recipient on Italy's basketball team who made it to that gold medal match, it's one of the biggest moments of your life.
When my teammate did the last shot and the shot in the air, I prayed, I hope that this shot enter. And it did.
From Dresden, for DW, I'm Kai Dombach.
And our sporting theme continues now as we check in with one of the biggest names in cycling, 4 times Tour de France champion Tadej Pogacar. But this isn't a story about the Tour de France. Oh no, this is a story about a much more modest event entirely, a cycling festival that Pogacar has just hosted in his native Slovenia. In his home village, in fact, a tiny place with a population of just over 1,000 people in one of Europe's smallest countries. Guy Delaunay was in Comenda to meet him.
Welcome to Comenda. This village is about an hour's leisurely bike ride from Slovenia's capital, Ljubljana. And normally, just 1,000 people live here. But the population's swollen to several times that number because Comenda's most famous son has returned in triumph. That's Tadej Pogacar, the world's greatest male cyclist.
For me, it's very important. I'm very glad that he can come home.
Marita Pogacar is Tadej's mother and was helping visitors park their bikes at Comenda.
It's not a typical reception for him, but it's more active. It's more in Tadej's way to celebrate his victories so far this year.
How has Comenda changed, do you think, since all of Tadej's success?
People are very proud of him. They are watching bike races they didn't before. Even ladies of 80 years watch TV now because of cycling. But people or life in Comenda didn't change very much.
Tadej Pogačar isn't just the best male cyclist of his generation. He's on course to become the greatest of all time. He's already won the Tour de France on four occasions, plus the World Championship, the Giro d'Italia, and multiple titles in the prestigious one-day races known as Classics. So it's all the more remarkable that he's putting time, effort, and resources into supporting a children's cycling club known as, what else, Poggy Team.
When I was a kid and I was cycling, it was the way of life, and I find my friends for life in cycling, and I created my life around the bike. So yeah, I'm not saying that I hope the same for all the kids, but I hope they find something that they really enjoy, not to force themselves into something they don't want, just to have a great life all around the bike, not just competitiveness and racing and adrenaline, just all other aspects as well.
Should the rest of the cycling world be afraid, not just of what you're going to do next, but of what these new young riders are going to do as well?
They don't need to be afraid of anything. It's just we will see more and more Slovenian flags in the World Tour and big races. They should be prepared for that as well.
The roads on the impromptu race circuit around Commender are full of Poggy Team jerseys. That's evidence of the champion's commitment to offering young riders opportunities to take part in the sport. Luka Muha is one of the Poggy Team coaches.
Tadej's influence is very big. He brings a lot of his own sponsors to the team. It's very good because when I was younger, before Poggy Team was the thing, you know, it wasn't like this, you know. We had to buy our own bikes. We had to, you know, we were racing on aluminium wheels. But it was not bad, you know. It was just normal. But now, you know, they are grateful for everything that they get because, you know, they know that a few years ago it wasn't like this.
Slovenia's seen a boom in cycling participation thanks to an era of unprecedented success. It's not just Tadej Pogačar. Primož Roglič and Matej Mohoric have also won multiple prestigious races. Andrzej Bašel has two sons who've trained with Poggy Team, and he says the star power has substance behind it.
I think the kids are really proud that they are in the team with Tadej Pogačar, and Tadej Pogačar really wants to be involved. You know, a lot of famous athletes just gave the name for their school. But in Slovenia, we also have a lot of foundation. Matej Mohoric has one, Luka Mezgec has one, Primož Roglič has one. So they all give back to community, because 15 years ago, cycling was not so popular as now. Now everybody is watching. It's like football.
Some of the stars of professional cycling came out to join Tadej Pogačar in a friendly but frighteningly fast elite race around Commender. Matej Mohoric told me cycling and Slovenia are a natural fit.
Slovenia is a really, really good place for a cyclist to grow up. If you want to be a professional cyclist, we have super nice roads, a great environment, a good infrastructure, a good cycling teams that support young riders.
How do you make sure this isn't just a moment, but it's something that sustains into the future?
I think Slovenian nation always has been a nation of sport. I think this is just in our DNA. I think the environment plays a huge role in this, and the sports infrastructure that we have. I think it's a paradise for cyclists, and it's inevitable that the success that current generation of professional riders have leads to motivate more young riders.
The Italian veteran and former European champion Matteo Trentin was also in Commender. He says he's not surprised by the Slovenian dominance.
I'm from the northeast of Italy, so we were used to see Slovenian kids coming over and being really good in the under-17, juniors and under-23. They always come to Italy to race, and they were always super strong, so, I mean, I'm not surprised.
How do you think they use this now? They've got these superstars. So what do they do going forward, do you think?
Already having a guy like today, but they have also Primož Roglič, Matej Mohoric, and a few other young professionals coming through. The base is the secret. You have a champion in the future. And if you see how many kids were here today, then it's a good start.
It may seem a bit bizarre to be talking about the future when Tadej Pogacar is very much a man of the present. He'll be looking to defend his world title next month and mopping up more one-day classic victories before the end of the season. And here's a fact to really worry his competitors. He's still only 26. Guy Delaunay, DW, Commenda.
Just one more sporting event to mark off on our August calendar now, but it is a corker, so stay tuned. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Heard of the Palio di Siena, a traditional horse race around the city's main square? Well, this isn't that. Just down the road from Siena, in the smaller but equally beautiful hill town of Montepulciano, there is another Palio which is 100% animal friendly, because instead of horses, the participants race with wine barrels. Nope, they don't ride them, they push them. But I will let Danny Mitzman explain the details.
The Bravio delle Botti is to the people of Montepulciano what Carnival is to the people of Rio de Janeiro. It's the culmination of 10 days of festivities featuring costumed processions, flag waving and drumming, and of course, plenty of eating and drinking. Held on the last Sunday of August, which this year also happens to be the last day of the month, the Bravio delle Botti marks the end of summer with the most magnificently madcap race imaginable. 8 two-man teams compete by pushing a gigantic wine barrel weighing roughly 85 kilos from the lowest part of the old hill town all the way up the winding streets to the finishing line, namely the steps of the cathedral in the main square. It's a 1 mile or 1.6 kilometre route, and the whole thing lasts less than 10 minutes. Centuries ago, like Siena, Montepulciano had a palio with horses. But when a local priest decided to revive the traditional race back in the 70s, he came up with the idea of substituting horses with wine barrels.
The Bravio was recreated in 1974. I was a teenager at the time.
Susanna Crociani is the vice president of the Consortium of Wine Producers.
It was something very special because it's an occasion to stay all together and to spend time in the different contrada. You know, contrada is like a little district. Montepulciano is divided in 8 contradas, and you belong to the place where you were born. And you know that it's something very special, the atmosphere that you can find, and really you breathe when you are in Montepulciano in this special week.
If you've put 2 and 2 together, you'll have worked out that the 8 barrels in the race represent the 8 contrade, and they all take the competition very seriously.
Per tutto l'anno il contradaiolo.
The people of the Contrade look forward to the last Sunday of August all year, says 29-year-old Lorenzo Leonardi. We don't talk about anything else, and there's enormous excitement and trepidation. Lorenzo's one of the so-called spingitori, or barrel pushers, and one half of last year's winning team. While most kids grow up dreaming of one day becoming firefighters or footballers, in Montepulciano they dream of becoming champion barrel pushers.
Da piccoli si vedono vediamo I grandi spingitori, gli atleti veri.
When we're little, he says, we look on in awe at the barrel pushing athletes. There's great veneration. Then your moment comes and you're filled with tension and adrenaline, knowing this year it's your turn. Lorenzo's been training since he was 10, and we're talking Olympic-style training. We have about a month off after the race, he tells me, and then in September, October, we start preparing for the next year. Training involves running, working out at the gym, and, of course, barrel pushing. As the race date approaches, training increases to 6, sometimes even 7 days a week. And the only time they can practice on the route itself is at night during the pre-race days of festivities.
The couple of athletes that are competing for their neighborhoods, their contrada, are rehearsing along the racetrack every night. So it's very spectacular also to see.
That's Irene Bettolini, the regitrice or governor, and the first woman ever to be entrusted with the Bravio's most prestigious official role.
It is a hard job, and you have to give all your heart and soul. People that are living far from Montepulciano taking time off, people that still live here, they're taking time off. I personally take some time off from work to, you know, manage everything in the best way possible.
Yes, even people who've moved away book annual leave to come back and take part. And whether you're 6 or 76, every role is voluntary.
There is someone that maybe, I don't know, is a professor or is a doctor, whatever, and maybe is just cooking pasta for the people or playing with the flags or playing with drum, or people love also to be part of this historical parade and to dress these special clothes. There is always a way, different way to be part in the contradas.
And of course, the contradas managed to turn everything into a competition. Best flag wavers, best drummers, best costume, even best pici al ragù, Montepulciano's signature pasta dish. But the most important one is, of course, the barrel race.
What happens just right before the race is very special, because at the starting line, there's an unreal silence. And then we start to hear the bells from the town hall. And they will keep ring for the entire time that the race is going on. So that's a very recognizable sound that makes the bravio.
With all this pomp and ceremony, you may be wondering what the prize is. Well, it's the bravio itself, a hand-painted 2-metre cloth banner worth more to the contrade than any amount of cash. And being Montepulciano, litres of celebratory wine are guaranteed to flow. If you win, you drink a lot of vino nobile, Lorenzo admits, because the winning contrada tours around all the other contrade with the bravio, and each one offers them a glass of wine. So by the end of the evening, the winners have had quite a bit.
The most special thing about this week, everybody is outside and celebrating together, which is something very particular and something that we are very proud of.
That barrel of laughs there, courtesy of reporter Danny Mitzman in Montepulciano. I think it is time for me to bow out gracefully now. This episode of Inside Europe was produced by Charlie Shield with help from me, Kate Laycock, and Laura Kabelka. Our sound engineer was Gerd Georgi. Our address for feedback is insideeurope@dw.com, and our Spotify poll of the week will, of course, have a sporting theme. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.